Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John. This is a no cut special. It's a no cut special, ladies and gentlemen. Hank and I just talked on the phone to each other without noticing how much time it elapsed. And like a high school couple falling in love, we talked for an hour and a half and the time just melted away. And so here we are. It's the beginning of 2022. We've got a hard out in 44 minutes. And this is going to be an amazing episode of Dear Hank and John. Hank, do the intro.
To Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John, what do Attila the Hun and Winnie the Pooh have in common?
What do they have in common, Hank?
They have the same middle name!
That's actually, I enjoyed that. I don't know if I'm just kind of giddy from the excitement of trying to do a one-take New Year's special or not. I love that joke. I really like that joke.
Thanks.
I do. I think I like it so much because Attila the Hun and Winnie the Pooh really do have very little in common except for their middle name.
I bring that up, John, because one, apparently this week one of the days is Winnie the Pooh Day. Oh. Which one is it? I forgot. I noticed it, but also because Winnie the Pooh this year is entering the public domain.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's time for you to do whatever the heck you want with Winnie the Pooh.
It's yours,
John,
now.
What do you want to do with Winnie the Pooh?
I read somewhere that H.P. Lovecraft also entered the public domain and that it was high time for a great mashup, for a Winnie the Pooh Lovecraftian narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, my publisher, Dutton, is the publisher for Winnie the Pooh. So, of course, this is a sad day. This is a sad
terrible
day for them.
I take it back. It's not fun at all. It's terrible news. I'm so sorry for your loss. Your economic, purely economic loss.
Right. Yeah. No, the benefit of society, but to the detriment of one privately held corporation. Hank, let's answer some questions from our listeners, beginning with this one.
I thought we were going to talk about Winnie the Pooh for way longer than that.
Well, we can if you want to. I mean, I'm a fan.
How many
of Winnie
tentacles
the Pooh.
Is Winnie the Pooh going to have?
Wait, is Winnie the Pooh going to be a bad guy? I was kind of thinking that Winnie the Pooh is going to be a hero, like living in a Cthulhu world.
No, it's 100. No. Christopher Robin is the hero, and the 100-acre wood is Lovecraftian now.
No.
And so you've got an owl with 18 eyes.
Come on.
And he's like knows everything.
No,
but he's also kind of mean about it.
I want to yes and you, but isn't the Lovecraftian world coming in from the outside trying to get into the 100-acre wood, and like then Tigger's defending it and Eeyore's like, oh, I guess I'll have to kill another octopus today. Killing makes me feel even more sad than I already did, but it's a violent world here in the 100-acre woods.
All right, I'm in. You've swayed me. You've convinced me.
There
and
you
also,
go.
I want to point out that was 100% worth it. What's the first question?
We're going hard today. Like, we came in hot. Maybe we should talk for an hour and a half offline before we do every episode. This first question comes from Natalie, who writes, Dear John and Hank, why is it that on the inside of a spoon, you are reflected upside down, but on the other side of a spoon, your reflection is right side up? Sincerely, Natalie. Oh, Hank, as I understand it, this is about concave and convex mirrors, which continue to be impossible for my little brain to understand. Like, every time I'm in a funhouse, which admittedly it's been a while, but like every time I'm in one of those carnival settings and they have the weird mirrors that make you look super skinny or super tall or super wavy or whatever, every single time I get in front of like a mirror that makes me look wavy. And I don't think like, how does that mirror work? I think, I just became wavy.
People do not understand how mirrors work. Like
It's very weird.
It is. Well,
because they look like a picture of you, of your
world.
But they're not.
They're not. They're a little window into back. What? It's just photons go in straight lines and they bounce off of things in perpendicular direction. So it's a flat sheet.
They don't go in straight lines. They go in waves.
they act like they go in straight lines.
They go in straight lines. that are also wavy lines. So it only gets harder.
They go in straight lines. The waves go in straight lines.
Yes, the waves go in straight lines. And what a sentence that is to start off our crash course on physics.
This, I am definitely the right person to talk to. I took optics as a section of my physics class in high school.
Yeah, so
I know
ready.
All about this. So when it's a flat mirror, mm-hmm. it's going to bounce off 90 degrees. But when it's a curve, every little point on that curve is going to bounce off in a different direction, because the mirrors are all at different angles to the photons that are coming straight in. And if you draw the little map, then you can see, oh, I see how it flips over. My brain still doesn't understand it, but I see, oh, the little thing that like crossed, and now like the photons from the top are at the bottom once they get to my eyes. And if you get close enough to a spoon, I think you can actually make it flip back up over, because you like get to the point where they're not crossed anymore. It just looks distorted. But the thing that gets me, John, mm-hmm. is that it doesn't flip left to right.
Yeah. No, that is weird.
And I'm like, is that because it's not curvy enough? Is it like, it? What? Why?
Yeah. What,
can you make a spoon where it flips left to right?
Mm.
Where you like raise your right hand and it goes up on the other side I don't know.
And everybody always talks about, well, this spoon is good at holding milk, or this spoon is good for soup or whatever. And nobody ever talks about this spoon flips your right and your left.
Right. Well, I think you could make a spoon that doesn't flip you.
And I think
you'd have to be like really far away to get flipped.
Right.
You'd just be worse at being a spoon, but better at not turning you upside down.
All right. I think that's a good answer. This next question comes from Avery. We're speed running this thing, Hank. Dear John and Hank, I've recently gotten into listening to the podcast, and it's got me thinking more about space. Me too, Avery. I think about space all the time. How weird is it that we're in a vast universe that is maybe infinite, but
probably
also expanding? I've recently gotten into thinking about space. I was wondering how or if we know that the Earth is straight up and down, with the northern hemisphere on top and the southern hemisphere on the bottom. Avery, I am about to blow your mind. Are we just walking around upside down all the time? Is upside down even real? There you go. You're almost there. What is upside down? Like, does it change as the Earth moves? And if we do know, would it matter if the Earth was flipped the other way? Pumpkins and penguins, Avery, there is no up.
There's no up.
There's no down.
There's an out. There's a down. There's no up, but there is a down.
How is there a down?
Well, it depends on your frame of reference. But down is toward the center of the Earth, whereas up
is in
every direction away from the center of the Earth.
It's not like the southern hemisphere is below the northern hemisphere, because there is no up.
No, and weirdly, so before we get to this, John, we're going to talk about this question for the entire rest of the episode. We're going to do two questions. It was our first one and this one.
We can't. We got some real quality questions coming up.
All right. Well, I'll try to get through it fast. But before we do, have I told you about my new way of visualizing an expanding universe?
You have. And everybody has seen the TikTok. Actually, one of the questions is about your TikTok. So maybe we should
save it for then.
Maybe we're going to save it. This is the kind of thing, by the way, that usually we would cut, but we're in the no cut zone right now. So here we go. Hank.
Yes.
Forget about that. Just answer the question. Uh-huh. Is there an up? Is the northern hemisphere above the southern hemisphere?
So this is one of the great coincidences that we don't notice, because it is so, it worked. So it could have been that we decided that the top of the map was east or west. And if we had, and in fact, many maps before we sort of standardized on north being the thing to put on the top, many maps did have east and west at the top. And if we had done that, it would have been very confusing when we noticed that the Earth is in a solar system and it is rotating in a way where like the plane of the solar system doesn't have a top and a bottom, but it has an orientation where you can pick a top and a bottom. But if we had picked east or west as the top of the map, we would have been like, oh, so this doesn't actually work.
We would have had
to stick with it, and it would have been annoying.
Yeah.
It would have been annoying for everyone forever, but it was a 50-50 chance and we got it right.
Yeah. In the same way, by the way, that like a 12-month calendar is annoying all the time.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make any sense to have some months have 31 days and other months have 28 days. And that's annoying. but we can't solve it because it was standardized before we totally understood what it all meant.
Yeah. And like that, that I can forgive us for, but minutes, 60 minutes.
Yeah. No, minutes are another great example. But the point is that there is an orientation, but
there's an orientation of the solar system.
It is not accurate to say, like, it could just as easily be south is up as north is up.
From
space, they are the same. You can see south is up or you can see north is up if you're looking at Earth from the sun. And there is no special reason why north is up except for like the political geography realities of why global maps came to be and who was drawing them.
Yeah. And it affects how we imagine the planet. It affects how we imagine each other. Like
In fact, I have written a book on this topic called Paper Towns, where I say that it is true that our maps, that the world shapes our maps, but it is also true that our maps shape the world.
That's wow, John. Why would we go further than that? It's almost like you should like write professionally.
Well, instead, I'm going to ask you this question about TikTok from Annalise. Dear John and Hank, how famous is Hank on TikTok?
Oh, that's a great question. I would like someone to answer this question.
This is
for
so
me.
Good. Everything about this question is A++++. I keep seeing random people I know commenting on how Hank is relevant now because of Gen Z and TikTok. I love the idea that like Hank went through a long period of irrelevance, but now is relevant again. And that is, there's something really brutal about putting it that way, but maybe it's true. I don't use TikTok. God bless you, Annalise. Never change. I just follow the account on Twitter that reposts all of Hank's TikToks. Oh, so you use Twitter. Yeah. So it's not like you're enlightened or anything. Can you quantify how famous Hank is on Twitter? Like, sorry, that would have been cut, but we're in a no-cut zone. Can you quantify how famous Hank is on TikTok? Does Cardi B have a TikTok? Is Hank more or less famous than Cardi B on TikTok? Or is it views that matter, not followers? I'm so confused. Tell the landlord I signed my name, Annalise.
Cardi B has more followers than me on TikTok.
Yeah.
But like not that many anymore.
Not that many more at all, actually. I'm going to look now, right now. I mean, I have an astonishing number of followers considering that
considering you don't do any, like, I'm very jealous of the amount of work you've put into your followers.
I put in no work into having, every other video I see on my For You page is from you. And I'm just like, God, Hank makes a lot of TikToks.
It's very easy. It's so easy to make a TikTok.
It's not easy. It's extremely stressful. And the actual story, I don't think you know this, Hank, but this is the actual story. And this is something that I love that is pretty secret. I make a lot of TikToks. I make like two or three every week. I just leave them up for like 7 minutes. And then I'm like, nah, I'm not enjoying this experience. And then I private it.
Yeah.
And then so I have like a lot of TikToks. It's just that they've all been privated because I let them get like 1,000 views and I'm like, nah, I don't like the vibe. I'm not enjoying this vibe. And there's something really like wonderful about that. So you have 6 million something followers on TikTok, which is a lot. And Cardi B has 15.7 million. So Hank is about just over one third as famous on TikTok as Cardi B. And I think that's about right. Like you're so big on TikTok that like regularly people say to me, your brother is very famous on TikTok, or I love your brother's TikToks. And then I say, did you know I also have 1 million followers on TikTok?
Yeah, it turns out that there is a truth to the fact that like the number of followers doesn't matter as much as the, like when it comes to like
whether a video gets out into the atmosphere.
Yeah. And yes, certainly. But also when it comes to like notability and recognizability, like more, if you have like 800 videos that got 1 million views a piece, that wasn't the same 1 million people every time. And so you end up with a lot of people. Whereas if you get like, you know, have 5 videos that have 1 million views a piece and you sort of have the same size audience, there are far more people will have seen the content or have been exposed to you multiple times, which is really sort of what starts to generate notability. What happened, John? This was actually very weird for me. I don't know if I've talked about this in public before, but like during the pandemic, I started making TikToks a lot because I was sad and bored.
Yeah.
And it brought me joy. And then the pandemic sort of like, you know, like things started opening up back a little bit. And I realized that I had one, maybe I had just forgotten that I get recognized in public, but two, I just think it was happening a lot more.
Yeah.
And that like a fair percentage, like maybe half of the people who are recognizing me were recognizing me from TikTok.
Right.
And so like, yeah, I think it is substantial and it is weird and it is.
Well, I have to say that the reason I delete these TikToks, I mean, there's a couple reasons, or the reason I private them, but one of the main reasons is that they start to like get like views from outside our community. And I'm like, nope. That's scary. And I don't like it. And I don't want that. And I'm totally, you know, that's not to say that like it's bad to want. I think there are lots of good reasons to want that like kind of audience. Like I just right now in my life, I just don't want it. And that's okay. As it's okay to want it. So I really like my TikTok strategy, but I have to say I love and am very grateful for your TikTok strategy because I love watching your TikToks. I think that they're so good. And I can't believe that you make them in addition to doing everything else.
I find it very easy to make a TikTok. And of course, Peyton helps to make it all seamless and simple. Who is our TikTok assistant, though I don't know how often utilize her services.
Not for the ones I delete after 7 minutes, usually. Yeah. Only for the ones I put an absurd amount of work into. I'll be I will text Peyton and say, Peyton, I have made a TikTok. That's how I say it every time.
I have made one of these ticky tockies.
Yeah,
and I would like for
it's an event. You know, it's like stop all the clocks. A TikTok has been created.
Yeah, I could definitely imagine spending a lot of time making a TikTok, and there are a couple I spent a substantial amount of time on. But mostly, I make them quite quickly. It is a platform that is designed for my style. Yes, I feel both fortunate and trapped a little bit.
Yeah,
that's
very much how I felt about Tumblr in 2012 and 2013. I was like, this is a place that was made for my way of expression. And then that feeling changed.
I don't know what you mean, John.
And it hasn't, interestingly, and perhaps not coincidentally, it hasn't come back.
Like, yeah.
I don't think I will ever feel that way again. And that's okay too. All right. Mm-hmm. This next question, it comes from Nico. It comes from Emily, who writes, Dear John and Hank, I vaguely remember from science class, I'm doing a lot of science questions, Hank, because I only have 8% power. And so you're going to have to ask the last three or four questions. Okay. I vaguely remember from science class that there is always the same amount of stuff in the world because matter cannot be created or destroyed. But when I watched the Perseverance rover land on Mars, I realized that all the stuff that it's made from came from Earth and will never come back. We must also gain stuff when like meteors come to Earth. But in the last 50 years, have we made a net loss or a net gain of stuff? What about in the last 1,000 years? My name is so common, it will become my generation's Karen, Emily.
Well, I'm so glad that you asked, John, because Deboki did a bunch of research to answer answer this question, which is a great question.
It's a great question. Is Earth a net gainer of stuff or a net exporter of stuff?
Yeah.
Is our trade deficit with the universe?
The first thing is that matter can neither be created nor destroyed, but that's a universe rule, not an Earth rule. So
right,
matter can definitely arrive at and leave Earth. And yes, a Mars rover is part of that, but it is a tiny, tiny piece of what leaves Earth. Which is mostly gases that are escaping.
A lot of atmospheres.
Yeah, atmosphere gets up there and it gets ionized and it gets blown away by the solar wind. This is where helium goes. This is why there's no helium in our atmosphere, or very little helium in the atmosphere, despite the fact that it's always being emitted by the Earth from radioactive breakdown, because it's lighter than the atmosphere. It ends up going
up
high
and then it gets ionized and
gets thrown off into the... Yeah. So about 1,600 tons of helium escapes every year.
Wow.
But the most of it is actually hydrogen. We lose about 3 kilograms of hydrogen every second. That's 95,000 tons a year.
Wow.
So that's the majority of how we lose
all right,
mass.
So we are, and it should be added that just because I like to bring it back to death and apocalypse, that like it, eventually it's true that matter is neither created nor destroyed, but like eventually the earth will be subsumed inside of the sun. And so like the earth will be at a net loss of 100%.
Yeah, that eventually that will be a different mechanism that is not currently operating.
Right, but
on
I'm
us.
Just saying, like, eventually the overall story is going to be that Earth loses mass.
Yeah, well, by not existing anymore.
Yeah. The same way
that we're not sure. We're actually not sure that the sun's going to get bigger than the Earth's orbit.
Great.
It's like kind of on the line. So regardless, a lot of Earth will be baked off in that process, and it will lose a lot of mass. Including all of the living parts.
What an exciting party that's going to be. I'm really glad that none of us or any of our descendants will be here to see it.
But I did not say that the Earth loses mass in total, because it also gains mass.
Yeah, from like meteors coming in.
It's mostly space dust. So about 40,000 tons of space dust falls to the planet every year.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a day. And I was like, no. Dang. Jeez. Am I inhaling it? Is it in my nose?
Do I need an N95 all the time?
Is that why,
is that
I, got
why
the
I
flu?
Feel this way?
Did I get the flu from breathing in space dust? That reminds me when the Halley's Comet came to the U.S. in the early 20th centuries, and people bought all these comet umbrellas because it was so close that the Earth actually passed through the tail of Halley's Comet. And they knew it was going to be that close, and people were really, really freaked out. And so there was all these like anti-comet medicines that you could take to like have the gases not affect you. And people had these umbrellas that they were used when they were outside to try to like keep the gases from the comet away. And of course, like it turns out that that's not a huge health risk, or indeed a health risk of any kind. So,
no, but it is good to freak out about whatever.
Yeah, that's what it. I mentioned that mostly to remind all of us that we have always freaked out about whatever. Hank.
Yes.
Are we a net exporter or a net importer of stuff?
We're losing weight, John. We're losing about 50,000 tons a year.
I knew it. We are. Yep. Things are slowly falling apart. I knew it. I knew that we had less of a planet than we did when I was born.
I have to say, if you found out that the Earth was getting bigger, you'd also be worried about it.
I would be like this is terrible.
The gravity is going to be way too much.
It's going to weigh too
much. We're going to be stuck to the ground. We're not going to be able to play basketball anymore.
That's right. My bone density won't be nearly able to deal with this. People's vertical leap will go way down. Nobody will ever break any of LeBron James's records. You're right. I would have been totally worried about all of that. This is going to completely change. You're right. But we are losing enough weight that it doesn't matter much, right?
The Earth is 6.5 billion trillion tons.
Okay.
And we lose 50,000 tons a year. So you're going to have to go ahead and just assume that your brain cannot conceive of the tininess of the fraction of the mass we lose every year.
Okay, that's helpful. That reminds me of a conversation I recently had with Alice, where she was like, you know, the oceans are going to boil and like all of life is going to die. And I was like, yeah, but we won't be here. It's like a couple billion years away. And like, she was like, why won't we be here? And I was like, I mean, you know, like there's a lot of reasons why we probably won't be here, Alice. Like, you know, we've been around for 250,000 years. You're postulating that this is the first like one billionth of human history or whatever. And she was like, that's not comforting.
So instead of like, knowing when it's going to happen, it could happen at any time.
Exactly. It could happen today or tomorrow, but for sure I know it won't happen in a billion years. That's way too long. We never have a chance to make it that far. You don't have to worry about that at all. And she's like, you've introduced a lot of new worries.
Yeah.
I want to go back to just worrying about a billion years from now. That was way easier.
Oren doesn't know about the species-wide existential dread yet, which is a perk of having a five-year-old. But he is, because Cameo died this year, he is aware of death.
Yeah.
And he has figured out that he is going to die, but he has not figured out that we are going to die. Because I think he sees himself more like Cameo than he is like us.
Yeah.
Because like he's like small and taken care of by us.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so like, so he clearly thinks that he's going to die before us, which of course, big hopes for that not to be the case.
Yeah.
But he is often asking like what will happen to us after he dies. And I'm just like, this is not how it's going to go, buddy.
Right. Not statistically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talking about death with kids is very hard. And this is a no cut special, Hank. So I don't want to drift too far into
to stuff where we might, where we might have to cut
because we do that a lot of times. When Hank and I talk about serious stuff,
we need to talk about to process together.
It's usually like 17 takes. And then eventually we're like, you know what, Tuna, just cut it. So instead of doing all of that, I'm just going to go to the next question while I still have 4% power. This is a high stakes game over here. I mean,
he's sweating. He's sweating
what's up
over
with
there.
My brand new fancy pants MacBook suddenly draining battery like it's going out of style. This question comes from Charlotte. And she writes, "Dear John and Hank, my name is Charlotte, and I was wondering if there's a reason you guys have amazing eyelashes. I've been noticing because
not
most
you
of the guys,
guys.
Yeah, you guys.
Me and you?
Oh, wait. No. Dang it.
I didn't think it was you guys.
Dang it. That's so disappointing.
You thought that Charlotte just really loved our eyelashes?
I mean, I was riding the high, the likes of which you've never seen, Hank. I was on a unicorn flying over a rainbow, and then I've just come crashing back to Earth. My name is Charlotte, and I was wondering if there's a reason that guys in general have amazing eyelashes. I've been noticing that most of the guys I know, not Hank and John, other guys, have lashes that I can only achieve with mascara. My own boyfriend has better eyelashes than me. Is this genetics or just a weird coincidence? Thank you, and I love the podcast. Apparently not enough to love our eyelashes, Charlotte."
I mean, we're included.
I don't feel like I
don't know. I felt like I was called out
for my beautiful eyelashes. And then it's the equivalent of like if you're in a meeting and somebody looks at you and they're like, "You have the most beautiful eyes." And then you say, "Thank you." And then they say, "No, not you."
The person right behind you. Yeah. Is that a thing that happens to you in meetings?
No, I got halfway through that story and I was like, why did I set this at a meeting instead of at a bar where it would be like vastly more appropriate, but still a little weird?
Actually.
Oh, man. This no-cut special is really stressing me out. Hank, is there a reason? Is this real or is this just a coincidence?
It's real. Oh. Guys have longer eyelashes on average.
Wow.
But the question of why, I don't think has been researched deeply, but like I will point out that guys are hairier in general.
Yeah.
So like
true.
Maybe it's just that. Like it's just like we got more hairs.
Yeah. I think it's funny. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I think it's funny that we think so much about like the differences in humans. Because, and there are a lot of differences, but yeah. I've just been looking at like pictures of orangutans lately and being like, I wonder if they like think like, oh man, that one's so tall. Like this one's so little. And like, that one has amazing eyelashes and like, oh my God, look at that guy's, you know, beautiful brown eyes. And we're like, they're all just orangutans.
I've ever told you about the time when I found a squirrel with Catherine and when I was in college and it was like a baby squirrel and it had been abandoned.
Oh no.
And we were like, we need to get this squirrel to someplace where someone can take care of it.
Yeah.
And we took the squirrel to the squirrel rehab person.
Sure.
Who was a woman who lived in her house. She just had a house and she rehabbed squirrels there and took us inside and there was like some cages and, you know, and she was like, I rehab them and then I let them go. And I was like, where? And she's like, here. And I was like, oh, this isn't like create a little bit of an open population of squirrels right here. And she's like, yes, but I feed them. So it's okay. Mm. And you want to see them. And I was like, I guess I'd want to see the squirrels. I see a lot of them, but you know, they're your squirrels. So please show me. She goes outside with like a bag of food and like a rain. It's like, it's like when you, if you were to open a sewer and the cockroaches, like that's like that level of squirrels just sort of showering down, where it was almost creepy. Like it was like to like Lovecraftian squirrel situation.
Ooh, and that's then a nice, that's a nice addition. We got to work with that. But go on, finish the story.
Then and then she starts to talk about the squirrels as individuals, and I was like, "How do you? But how do you know?"
Yeah.
It's like his face,
right? By appearance, yeah.
By looking at his face, because his face is his face, and I was like, "Oh,
yeah." Tesla could do the same thing with pigeons, and I can't even do it with people. Like every time we're watching a TV show and I'm like, is that the brother? And Sarah's like, it's the husband. Oh my God. How does this keep happening? Which reminds me that today's podcast is brought to you by Hank's Squirrel Lady. Hank's Squirrel Lady. She recognizes them by the faces.
Yeah. And she, and I'm, I hope, and I believe that she took great care of that squirrel.
Sure.
This podcast is also brought to you by spoons that don't actually flip you upside down. They're just flat. It makes it very hard to have the soup, but you will be normal way up.
Yeah. Today's podcast is also, of course, brought to you by Earth's Weight Loss. Earth's Weight Loss, now using Noom.
Oh my God. And finally, this podcast is brought, and also this podcast is brought, that we're going to make Tuna edit it because I said finally.
No, we don't have to, Hank. Just keep going. Just plow through.
And also,
believe
this podcast
in
is brought to you by John's eyelashes, which are grand. They're like carpets. They're like the tentacles of a sarlacc.
I remember slightly off topic and not to name drop. I try hard not to do that. But one time when Cara Delevingne was in the Paper Towns movie, I made a Question Tuesday video with her, and somebody was like, can Cara review your eyelashes or something? And Cara, like very kindly and generously, she is a really kind person. Like ran her fingers through my eyelashes, my eyebrows,
oh,
and
eyebrows.
said, sorry, it's the no cut special. Like I can't retake
just imagining Cara Delevingne running her fingers through her eyelashes. Is
like how did she use two fingers?
Moment.
But she went through my eyebrows and she was like, they're a little thin, like not unkindly, just observationally.
Yeah. That's part
and
of her job.
True. And it's true.
She has to.
We also have a Project Rossa message to read from Puria to Christine. My wife suffers from schizophrenia, nevertheless uses much of her limited energy caring about others. A small example, while achieving top grades, the stress routinely caused her to faint. After waking up, she wouldn't let me ask anything before I told her how I was doing. My wife, the angel. You, Hank and John, have for 10 years been the friends she never had, albeit deserves. She says, thank you. That is so,
that is really
so
lovely.
Kind.
Yeah.
That is really lovely. That made my day, and I've actually had a pretty good day. So thank you very, very much. Thank you both for listening and for, feeling that closeness to us. That means a lot to us. Hank, you've got to ask the next question because I'm out of battery, man. It's over.
I'm just staring
into the abyss now.
You got right to the end of the Project for Awesome message.
I did.
And then just blink.
Yep.
Perfectly done. John, this next question comes from Sue, who asks, Dear Hank and John, what's the nearest planet I could burn down?
Like with a match? Like with this?
Yeah,
like, what's the nearest planet away?
Sue says, I would love to visit a planet and light it with a match and watch it disappear in a ball of flames.
Wow.
Thanks.
Wow. A literal example of somebody who just wants to see a world burn.
I just want to watch a world burn.
I mean, doesn't this capture something really deep about humans where it's like, could we burn down a world with a single match? Because I'm just going to tell you right now, if we can, we are gonna. That's going to be difficult urge to resist.
I have great news for worlds and bad news for Sue.
Oh, wow. No worlds, huh?
Well, I mean, I could be wrong about this. I'm just basing this on sort of how I understand chemistry to work, which is like, so burning is a thing that happens because there are chemicals that are complicated and they have lower energy states where they are simpler. So, for example, wood is just a big mess of long carbon chains that were formed by the plant combining oxygen and carbon dioxide and water together to create these big long carbon chains. And in order to do that, they had to like use energy. That's the whole thing that plants do.
Right.
So the process of taking that wood back and turning it back into carbon dioxide and water is the process of burning. Now you can also, but the thing is, you can't really build a plant out of these complicated high energy state molecules because they break down on their own over time anyway, if they can. So in order for there to be a fire in the way that we imagine them to be, the easiest way to it would be like a planet that's made out of hydrogen and hydrogen burns, right?
Right.
Except that if the hydrogen was there along with an oxidizer, so along with oxygen, it would have already undergone that chemical reaction through a slower process as it was forming, and so you'd just have the water, not the hydrogen and oxygen sitting side by side, because those chemicals are less stable than water is.
Well, so, okay, but imagine a planet, and I maybe this isn't possible, but imagine a planet that is only made out of hydrogen. Mm-hmm. Okay? Just a hydrogen planet. Yep. If I walk up to that planet and I light a match, it should burn to the ground, right?
Nope.
No,
there's no oxygen. What is it turning into?
Great point.
What is the chemical reaction?
You need oxygen for fires to work. I forgot about that. That's why you blow on the fire.
That's why you blow on the fire. That's why they bring liquid oxygen into space when they need to have a rocket work in space.
Whoa. Does that mean that it's not possible? Okay, so I want to take you to Star Wars, Hank, which is a documentary that was made about a civilization a long time ago in a galaxy far away.
Yeah, they were having a star war.
They had
a war in the stars.
I don't want to get too specific.
It was a stars war.
They had multiple star wars. That's why it's called Star Wars, because they had more than one war. Okay.
When I look back on it, Star Wars, the name of Star Wars is the worst thing about Star Wars. Like, if you say Star Wars to me, I'm like, Six Flags attraction. Like, it just sounds very silly.
It's true. This speaks to like the fact that, you know, the guy who created Star Wars was like obsessed with like the Jungian subconscious and Joseph Campbell's, ideas around myths and
people
everything. Yeah, obviously it worked out okay. I'm not here to criticize George Lucas's ability to understand what kind of stories work for people.
Yeah.
But there's this documentary called Star Wars that's about this stuff that happened a long time ago. But in the doc, there is a there's a giant weapon that's like almost planet-sized itself that uses a laser to blow up a planet.
Yeah.
That's possible.
Yeah, well, I don't know that it would.
To me, that's close to burning.
Right, but that's adding energy. And then the energy. So I don't think that there would be like a giant fireball in the way that maybe Star Wars has. I'm trying to picture.
I can't picture it either.
Alderaan blowing up.
There's no fireball. Yeah.
Spoilers, everybody.
But our listener could build a laser that would achieve the same thing, but it wouldn't be a kind of burning experience. So whatever pyromania.
Yeah, like, I could imagine a situation. You could blow a planet up. Like, I don't know if you could blow a planet. Like, I don't know if
I couldn't, Hank. I can't even light a fire, like a regular fire with dry wood.
I can't even do wood stuff. But yes, but if you got like a moon-sized object and got it going like 4% the speed of light and you hit the Earth with it, like you'd blow up a planet. Like, it wouldn't burn down, but it would blow up.
Hmm. Well, I'll tell Alice about that one. I'll tell her this afternoon. She'll be excited to hear that I've discovered a new thing to worry about.
Yeah.
All right. I think we've answered the question. Hank, we got to do one more question before we get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. I think we have time.
Yes.
We do. Hurry.
This question is from Scott, who asks, Dear Hank and John, I'm curious what matching funds actually mean. No. Do people with means donate more or less depending on what small money donations come in? I'm asking this maybe poorly, but basically, say there's $10,000 in one-to-one matching funds and a project generates $8,000 in donations. What happens to the extra $2,000? Why not just donate the full $10,000? Looking forward to the P4A, Scott.
So I think that, I mean, matching funds mostly serve as an incentive to get people who can donate less money to feel that their money is going further. And also, like, it incentivizes them to donate in the first place to, like, take advantage of the match.
Yeah.
I can't speak for what everyone does when the match isn't maxed out.
Several things can happen.
What we do is we give the money anyway because it would feel weird not to, and because we've generally made it.
We've allocated it. Yeah.
Right. But I know that there are instances of people being like, I give the matching fund, and if it's matched, it's matched. And if it's not, it's not. And
move that money over to some other matching fund and encourage donations at that organization or at a later fundraiser at this organization.
Or I just keep it. Yeah,
or so keep it, I guess. Yeah.
So I think there are a variety of responses to it. But in general, like I think because there was research that matching funds work, in general, there has been like a huge rush to matching funds over the last 5 years. And so you get emails that are like, if you donate $1 right now, it'll count as $7. And not to brag, Hank and I were sort of on the forefront of that back in the early days of the Project for Awesome. But that's what it comes down to. It comes down to people who are in a position to make large gifts, making those large gifts to encourage the people who are in a position to make smaller gifts to make smaller gifts. And in that sense, I think it's good. And certainly with our project, I some listeners to Dear Hank and John won't know about this, but we have a Nerdfighteria has a really large long-term project to build and staff and support a stronger healthcare system in Sierra Leone's Kono district. And that has raised, or is on track to raise, over $26 million over 5 years. And matching has been a really important part of how we've gotten to that number, because every dollar that gets donated monthly at pih.org/Hank and John gets matched by people who've come together to match that money. And it has worked. And so I don't know if it works in general, but it has certainly worked
well
at increasing fundraising.
It also helps us get money from the larger dollar donors, where it's like you can say to them, hey, if you give us this amount of money, it's almost like we're saying to them, your donation will be matched by these people. And
by
so
the,
you are
monthly
you're
donors.
Able to multiply your impact. So everybody gets to feel like they're doing a thing together and gets to feel like they're affecting the world even more than they otherwise would be, which, it's true. Like, it actually does work. So I kind of can't question it.
Yeah. So between the two groups, everybody ends up donating more, which is good. Hank, let's get to the all important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. I will go first. Wimbledon have been on a terrible run. We lost our third round FA Cup game against fifth tier Boreham Wood. I have to say, Hank, in other news, one of the teams that won their third round FA Cup game is a team name that is so absurd, so totally absurd, that you will not even believe it. The name of the team that won its third round FA Cup tie is Kidderminster Harriers. Kidderminster Harriers?
Kidderminster. You know, the village of Kidderminster.
And the Harriers, which is either like a small hawk or else like a person who's annoying. Which is magical. I was like, is a Harrier a person who makes a hat? And so I looked it up and no, it's just like a person who harries you, you know, a Harrier. Mm. Anyway, Wimbledon did not win. We lost to Boreham Wood, which also sounds like a made-up place name. And one cool thing, Phil Dunster, who's an AFC Wimbledon fan, in part because he was a fan of my FIFA series when he was a kid, who now plays Jamie Tart on Ted Lasso, was at the game with Jason Sudeikis, who plays Ted Lasso. So Ted Lasso attended an AFC Wimbledon game. That's pretty cool. We got our butts kicked by a fifth-tier team, though. We did not look good. And in our previous game against Oxford United, we looked even worse. Like, it was the worst I've seen us look under head coach Mark Robinson so for the last year. So it's really worrying. And tomorrow, as we're recording this, we play our first game this season against the franchise currently plying its trade in Milton Keynes. So that is, I really hope we perform well in that game because, you know, it's a game that shouldn't exist. And I think most Wimbledon fans will be boycotting it because it's in Milton Keynes and who wants to go there mm-hmm. to attend that yep. game for that occasion.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it's still an important game to the fan base. Like, there's no getting around the fact that we want to beat those guys. And, you know, we think we deserve to beat them. So we'll see how it goes. I'm really nervous going into tomorrow, though. So that's the news from AFC Wimbledon. What's the news from Mars? Or do we get news from the space telescope?
Well, I could do a little bit of both. So the Webb Space Telescope is doing fantastic. I don't know if you've been following this.
I've been following it every single sigh of relief, all 472 of them. It's been incredible.
I have a scale of my sighs of relief. I think we're in the approaching the mid 400s of 472, so we're getting quite close.
Great.
There are a number of things that, you know, still need to be tested, but like what the things that could still go wrong, unless like there are still some things that
count your chickens and
the mission, but like a lot of the things that like are my final sighs of relief are things that like if they went wrong, it would be a less good telescope, but it would still be the best telescope we have,
right?
Certainly infrared telescope that we have, so by a very wide margin. So like if one mirror didn't work, that would be like it would still be a great telescope, but like the mirrors focus themselves, and so right now they're going through and testing all 18 mirrors to make sure that they're focusing themselves correctly. And it's great. It's 100% deployed, and it is now in the process of being commissioned. So it is in its final configuration, and then commissioning is like you got to wait for it to get to the right temperature because it's designed to operate at very low temperatures. Mm-hmm. You have to calibrate all the instruments. You have to boot up some stuff. You have to make sure that all like you got to get all the mirrors in their perfect configuration, etc. So all that stuff takes a long time. So we will get our first picture in about 5 months, and like all of the hard parts are done. It went amazingly well and was like pretty much on schedule the entire time. A couple of moments where they were like, let's just make sure we know what's going on. But like a bunch of people made it happen, feel very good about it. In actual Mars news, I also have to mention, because this is like real Mars news. So the Perseverance rover has put a pause on its rock sampling efforts because of a rock that was in the wrong place, basically. So there's some stuff that is not where it's supposed to be, and that is affecting its ability to sort of move all of the parts that shuttle the stuff that it drills out of the ground around the rover to do chemical analysis on it. Mm-hmm. Now, they're basically little pebbles, and they probably fell out of a sample tube into the carousel where they are now blocking the drill bit from being able to sit inside the carousel spot. There is an easy fix for this, which is you just like, but like we want to be careful about it because we want the rocks to go somewhere where we know where they're going,
right,
rather than just like shake them off and like be like, I don't know where they ended up.
Yeah.
So there was some anticipation that something like this could happen. They're assessing the data and they're figuring out how to remove them correctly so that the rover can continue doing all of its science. So there's, of course, like there's lots of science it can do even if this thing breaks, but it is an important part of the mission. So the thought is that this will almost definitely be fixed and we will resume rock sampling soon.
And this is basically like the underlying idea here is that we take these rocks, we put them in a sampler, and then we're able to do chemical analysis to understand what they're made up of.
Right. Yes.
Which helps us to understand what Mars is made up of.
Yeah.
Which helps us to understand like where the water might have gone or when it might have gone, and lots of other things about the nature of Mars.
Correct.
That's, I mean, I hope they get that fixed soon. I can't imagine how hard it is.
There are like other ways that we do that. Like
I find it pretty difficult to like get all the rocks out of my lawnmower.
Yeah. And you're there with the
lawnmower. Exactly. I'm screaming at it. I don't know what else I can do other than lecture it and say, like, you shouldn't be picking up rocks in the first place. You're a lawnmower. You should be mowing lawns.
Thank you for making a podcast with me. We have to go.
We got to go. Thanks, everybody, for listening to our incredible, special, one-of-a-kind, no-cut special. Never doing it again. Unless we need to.
This podcast is edited by Joseph Tuna Medish. It's produced by Rosianna Hals Rojas. Our communications coordinator is Julia Bloom. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. The music you're hearing now is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.